Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Hello, everybody. We begin today behind the scenes at the U.S. Supreme Court. Conservative reaction has been bitter and fierce to a CBS News report that Chief Justice Roberts was first going to vote to strike down the individual mandate in the Obama health reform law, then changed his mind during the deliberations. The New York Times Supreme Court correspondent Adam Liptak joins us for this. Hi, Adam. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, good morning, Brian.
From the CBS report and anything else you've been able to learn, what do you know about the timeline? Was there a period first where Roberts was going to vote to throw out the mandate as unconstitutional?
Well, there are a bunch of indications on the face of the decision that's consistent with what Jan Crawford at CBS reported, that certainly the more conservative justices thought they had the chief's vote to strike down the entire law. Whether he changed his mind is more complicated. It's certainly possible that he said at the initial vote that he thought the law could not survive under the Commerce Clause, which was the argument that everyone was focused on. And from such a statement, it's possible that the conservatives took away the notion that they had won the whole thing. The Chief Justice almost certainly assigned the draft of the majority decision to himself. And so there comes a time when that draft circulates and he lives up to his indication that it's no good under the Commerce Clause, which is a huge holding, but nonetheless says that it can be sustained under a second part of the Constitution, under the congressional power to levy taxes. And whether that's a true change of mind or a misunderstanding, and precisely when it happens, very hard to tell, but something like that almost certainly happened. There are a lot of clues on the face of the opinion. And I guess I should add, before we go too far down this road, that there's nothing wrong with a judge thinking hard and considering alternatives and changing his mind in the process. I think that's what you want from judges.
Listeners, want to get in on this? Our comments page is now open at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show or call and talk to Adam Liptak, New York Times Supreme Court correspondent, 212-433-WNYC. And yes, I noted that you wrote in the Times that it is not particularly unusual for justices to change their minds while writing and exchanging drafts. Is that really true? You know, I think many people have the impression that this court is so ideologically locked in that changing their minds would be reserved for the few swing voters on the court like Kennedy is and Sandra Day O'Connor was. Not true?
Well, you know, it's true that a lot of 5-4 cases divide along predictable lines, but not all cases are 5-4 cases. They were unanimous 44% of the time. A lot of the other cases had odd scrambles, and justices will routinely say that they think they know what they want to do, but it won't write. When they sit down and try to write it out, it just doesn't make sense. You've probably had that experience where you have a thought and you try to put it on paper, and it's only then that you understand that there's a gap in the logic. So I don't think it's unusual as a general matter. I don't think it's unusual in high-profile cases. It may well be that the Chief Justice also took account of what probably would have been a lot of criticism from the other side had the court struck down President Obama's signature legislative achievement on a 5-4 vote where all of the conservative justices, every single one of them appointed by a Republican president, voted to strike down, and all four of the liberals, every single one of them appointed by a Democratic president, voted to uphold. That might have cast the court in a quite political light.
You noted in the Times that the rationale he used to uphold the law, the idea that the mandate was a tax rather than a requirement to buy, was one he pursued during oral arguments. Can you remind us who he questioned and how about that?
Well, Solicitor General Don Verrilli, who got such terrible reviews after the argument, had a really hard time getting around to his second point. His second point was this tax point, and it was at one point that the Chief Justice looks down at him and says, Mr. Verrilli, I'd like to hear more about the tax point. And there was a day, the arguments took 3 days. On the first day, in a different context about whether the court had jurisdiction to hear the argument, the Chief Justice seemed quite engaged about whether he could conceive of the penalty that is the only teeth behind the mandate, whether that could be conceived of as a tax.
And yet almost no one considered that a likely rationale for the court to actually hang its hat on. Do you think we all just missed something in the media in Justice Roberts' tone?
You know, I sure didn't see it coming. You have no lack of law professors now holding up their hands and saying, no, I thought about it. I thought it was always the tax. I mean, it was in the case. It didn't seem especially likely, even in his decision upholding the health care law on tax grounds. The Chief Justice didn't seem especially enthusiastic about it. He just said, listen, if there's a way to hold a law passed by Congress constitutional, it's my job to do that. It's not my job to overrule the democratically elected branches of government. If there's a plausible way to uphold it, he said this at least passed that test, that it was plausible.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We're talking about the revelations that Chief Justice Roberts seemed to start on one side and then change his mind with respect to the individual mandate in the Obama health reform law Supreme Court decision. 212-433-WNYC for Adam Lipdack, Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times, and Patricia on Staten Island. You're on the air. Hi, Patricia.
Yeah, hi. You know, when I heard that Chief Justice Roberts made a decision or he changed his mind, it occurred to me that maybe it had something to do with the decision on the super PACs, that the what corporations are people, and maybe he thought that that was a wrong, egregious decision on the justice's part, that he wanted to make a correction or something like that.
Patricia, thank you.
Point, Patricia, and it's true that the Citizens United case, which did divide 5-4 along ideological lines, has come in for a ton of criticism. The reason I think I resist your idea is that that same week that we got the decision in the healthcare case, the court summarily reaffirmed Citizens United, really with almost no discussion, said that a Montana Supreme Court case that had gone the other way had violated Citizens United, and the Chief Justice was part of that majority. So there's no particular reason to think he's having second thoughts about Citizens United as such, but it may be that he's having second thoughts about the perception and legitimacy and authority of the court.
Yeah. So to frame Patricia's question in that broader light, what do you think about Roberts' motivation for his vote? Because it is widely speculated, not that he felt bad about Citizens United, but he wanted to bring back the court's independent reputation by presiding over a health care vote that didn't break down along what appeared to much of the public to be partisan lines, as Citizens United and some other decisions did. So do you have any evidence that he could have made of his decision for that kind of reason?
You know, it's the only person who knows John Roberts' motivations is John Roberts. But I would think that any Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court views himself as a custodian of its reputation for independence and for judicial rather than political action. So I would not be at all surprised if he took into account the importance that his institution be respected along a broad range of cases. He's got many things he wants to do. He's only 57 years old. He's been on the court for 7 years. He'll probably be on the court for another 20 or maybe 30. And there's all sorts of things he wants to achieve. And it's harder to achieve them if people don't respect the institution.
Of course, if he did that for that reason, it would be a paradox. He would have made a political ruling to stop the court from being seen as political. You know what I mean?
In a sense, but let me steal a thought from a good reporter at the LA Times named David Savage. He says it's a funny thing to criticize the Chief Justice for being political when the four conservatives vote exactly as you would expect them to politically, the four liberals vote exactly as you would expect them to politically, and it's the Chief Justice who votes against what might be thought his political instincts, and he's the one who's being accused of being political.
Right. Yes. Well, that's an interesting interpretation. And at the same time, he could be seen as political in terms of trying to advance the stature of the court as an institution.
Yeah. Well, it's a kind of, Brian, it's a kind of three-dimensional chess, and there's a lot going on, and we have dribs and drabs of insights. And it's hard to know, but you could say that the Chief Justice, on the one hand, upholds the law. On the other hand, he delivers to the right, rulings both on the Commerce Clause and on the Medicaid expansion that it really ought to like.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a little surprising how, having more or less split the baby and given the right everything he could short of victory in the particular case on one piece of legislation, he's getting such vitriolic, bitter sense of personal betrayal from conservatives. I don't know that I would have predicted that.
Christine in Ditmas Park, you're on WNYC. Hello, Christine.
Hi. I had read that, the source of the original leak that Roberts had changed his mind had come, they presume, from the judges themselves who felt wronged by his switch over. And I was just wondering if that was something that had actually happened, if that's something that does often happen, because I would have thought it's such an airtight institution that sort of thing would never happen.
I think that Jan Crawford is a good reporter, and she has sources inside the courthouse. I think the likely suspects would be a justice or a law clerk. I think a justice is a much more likely suspect than a law clerk. The law clerks really do live and die by a code of silence, and it would be professional suicide for them to violate it, and that justices have on occasion been known to talk.
Well, but let's talk about the motivations, which I think Christine also asked about, because CBS cited two sources with specific knowledge about the deliberations. That was Jan Crawford's language on CBS. Two sources with specific knowledge about the deliberations. And you're saying likely justices themselves, because the law clerks would be committing professional suicide by doing it. The justices wouldn't. But leakers usually have motives. So do you think two justices wanted to give Roberts more of a public black eye, or maybe the opposite, try to unbloody him by explaining how he came to his decision?
If you read the piece, the tenor of the piece is that the chief did something illegitimate, that he changed his mind under pressure from the media and a speech from Senator Patrick Leahy. None of that, by the way, do I buy. But the tenor of the piece certainly read as though it was coming from the conservative wing of the court, who were very, very unhappy, having thought they'd won this case, to lose it, and to lose it because not because of the swing justice, Anthony Kennedy, who they had, but because of somebody they thought a reliable conservative, John Roberts. So the tenor of the piece really makes you think it comes from the right side of the court.
Plus, Jan Crawford reported there is bitterness on the court. That was kind of the lead angle on Face the Nation this week, her follow-up. There's bitterness
right.
on the
so
court.
That's all consistent. And Jan has good sources on the right, wrote a book about the court that was well-received by the right, has been praised in public by Clarence Thomas, who does not go out of his way to praise most journalists. So, this is all inference and speculation, but all of the evidence points to a leak from the right side of the court.
Adam Liptak, New York Times, Supreme Court correspondent, our guest, and Rick in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hey, good morning. I'm an attorney, and when you go to law school, you are taught in analyzing cases to look for decisions that need not be made and whether a case really stands for a proposition or not. Your guest called the Commerce Clause decision in this case a strong holding. In my view, it is complete dicta. Four of the justices had to say that they and are good for denying the Commerce Clause power because they would have struck down the law. What Justice Roberts should have done in judicial restraint is say, I don't have to reach the Commerce Clause question because I uphold the law under the taxing power.
So law professors are arguing whether those five votes amounted to dicta or holding.
Could you translate for the non-lawyers in the group?
So dicta is legal jargon for a comment made in passing that has no precedential effect, that has no legal force. The way the Chief Justice wrote his decision, he wrote it very carefully to make clear that he needed to get past the Commerce Clause point in order to reach the tax power, meaning that it is holding, binding law in his view. This is kind of, you know, a law professorial dispute rather than a real-world dispute, because whatever law professors say, a lower court judge is going to take seriously what five justices of the Supreme Court have agreed on. And if a Congress were to pass another law using this kind of mechanism, similar to an individual mandate, which, by the way, is very unlikely, but if a Congress was foolish enough to do it, there's every reason to think lower court judges and then this Supreme Court would also strike down such a law.
I guess Rick's point was that after upholding the law on the basis of the taxing clause, he didn't have to weigh in one way or the other on the Commerce Clause. And so that was kind of a voluntary gift to the conservative wing to strike down the expansive interpretation of the Commerce Clause to include the health care mandate at the same time as upholding it on other grounds, because he didn't have to go there.
Well, I think that's probably right, that he didn't have to go there. If you read the decision, though, he insists that he couldn't reach the tax power until he chewed through the commerce point. So he took pains to try to create an actual binding legal holding. Whether he succeeded or not, you know, is a theoretical issue only, because we know the answer that this court would give is that the next time this case were to come around, you'd have five votes for that proposition.
You know, if Roberts took this vote to rescue the court from its image of being politicized and increase its respect among the American people, a Rasmussen poll taken right after the decision found the public's opinion of the Supreme Court had declined, not increased. And I realize that's an immediate poll, and that's not going to say what's going to happen over time. Plus, I don't know if that's a Republican-weighted poll. Sean Hannity always calls Rasmussen his favorite pollster, so maybe it's wink-wink. I don't know. But have you seen anything else on public reaction?
That's all I've seen. I would have thought that this decision would split the baby kind of nicely, but I think I'm wrong about that. And I think in part thanks to these leaks, if it is the case that the Chief Justice wanted to preserve a kind of apolitical image of the court, he's failing, not because he himself failed, but because this sort of vitriolic aftermath from the right is portraying his own move as a political move.
Yeah. So if there is bitterness on the court, maybe more so than any time in nearly 70 years, as CBS reported, if that's true, what are the ramifications for the future of this court?
Well, it's a funny thing because the right still needs John Roberts. And it's you wonder whether if you're sufficiently nasty to him, whether you don't drive him over to the other side, whether you don't have an experience like you did with Harry Blackmun, who wrote Roe v. Wade, but was basically conservative. He took so much, got so much hate mail for that, that over time he grew more liberal. And you wonder whether this kind of attack from the right is not counterproductive as a strategic matter, whether it might not actually convert a lifelong hardcore movement conservative, which is what John Roberts is, into a swing vote like Anthony Kennedy.
Well, that would be a very interesting outcome. Time will tell. I guess if Dwight Eisenhower once said appointing Earl Warren was the biggest damn fool mistake he ever made, what's George W. Bush going to say someday about appointing John Roberts? Only time will tell. Adam Liptak, Supreme Court correspondent for The New York Times, thank you so much. Very interesting
Good
conversation.
Good to be here.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, with Romney trouncing Obama in fundraising recently, we will look at where the donations are coming from and a kind of money spigot that may be as important as super PACs known as 501c4s. Stay with us.